Today I will talk about imprints of primordial non-Gaussianity on large hadron structure. This talk is almost entirely based on this paper that I wrote with my collaborators Neil Dalal, Olivier Doré, and Alex Shirokov, who are in your neighborhood here at CETA. And amazingly, I don't think any of them actually showed up for this workshop. So locals here should give them a hard time for that. But anyway, I will talk about work based on this paper. To start with some basics. I don't think this audience needs any, but you know, generic inflationary predictions. There are only a few, and one of them is nearly Gaussian initial conditions, and this is what why we are having this workshop. We are after testing Gaussianity in maps of the early and late universe, including CMB. Now, let's see. So again, some of the introduction. We've heard a lot about one of the standard ways to parameterize non-Gaussianity with the FNL parameter. And this is a Gaussian gravitational potential, and this is a full non-Gaussian. This is a highly condensed and select list of papers that first examined non-Gaussianity. Now, what I would like to do is give a highly, extremely fast history of measurements of non-Gaussianity. And I'm completely not the right person to do this, but let me do it anyway. And actually, I was only around for maybe two-thirds or one-half of this in cosmology. It really started in early 1990s with the COBE maps, and that's around that time Gaussianity was first studied more seriously. So in particular, Kogat and al. COBE team found a Gaussian sky from COBE. And then it was all Gaussian until 1998, when there was a very interesting claim of non-Gaussianity in the bispectral measurements of COBE. So this is work by Ferreira, Magheja, and Gorski. What they did is they looked at the bispectrum for equilateral triangles, so B, L, 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 at L of 2, 4, 6, and so on until 18 here. These graphs show histograms. On the x-axis is the bispectrum value. On the vertical axis is the number of such realizations from Gaussian random, which is a histogram. And then the vertical line shows the COBE value. And you see what they say is all of them agree with Gaussian except L of 16, which is quite high on the tail. In fact, it's at the 98th percentile of the tail. And that value, they quote unquote rule out Gaussianity in COBE. And it's very interesting how this went away pretty quickly. First of all, people have pointed out that there is a known systematic effect in COBE where the experiment goes in Earth's shadow 2 months a year. If you take out that data, the effect goes away. And then, of course, nowadays, we would say, and this is what Eiichiro pointed out in his PhD thesis, that, of course, you do expect occasional deviations of this sort if you look at the multiple observables. And in fact, it's not unexpected that one of them will be on the tail. And he looked at many different bispectra and found perfectly fine agreement with Gaussianity. So that was the 1990s, and now the new millennium. What happened was, now I'm skipping a lot of work here, I'm sure. One paper that sticks out in my mind is Crotty Wu et al. On maxima data, checking off a lot of Gaussianity tests and seeing Gaussian, Gaussian, Gaussian. And then WMAP before 2008. Gaussianity consistent with FNL includes zero at two sigma, certainly. And then finally, of course, we have this claim for this audience. I will just mention it because we heard a lot about this yesterday. Yadav and Wandelt claim, and then also repeated and confirmed in a slightly different way by Komatsu et al. 2008, showing two sigma or slightly higher evidence for non-Gaussianity. So this is actually a subject of a lot of interest these days. In the future, we expect better constraints from Planck, order 10 or so constraints in FNL. There's lots of other things also that people are looking at, large-scale anomalies. And in my mind, one particularly interesting one is the C of theta, the angular real space correlation function that was measured to be low in COBE. And then even lower in WMAP1, and in fact in WMAP3, it's still lower. So if you look at these raw band maps between 60 and 180 degrees, C of theta vanishes to a level that's significant, 99.9%. So this is a subject of a lot of current work testing. And this, of course, this one mixes up isotropy and Gaussianity. So I I blurred that a little bit here.
I start tapping on anything. You mean test? I start tapping.
Right. So what I meant was that I wasn't thinking too much when I said I had lived a test of Gaussianity, because but of course some of these things are large-scale anomalies referring to isotropy. And so let me not get into that.
But if your statistics is non-Gaussian, then this could be more likely. Yeah.
That's true.
Because that 99.96% is based on a Gaussian statistic. So I suppose.
Yes, that is true. Okay. That is true, yes. That's certainly true. Okay, so the subject of this talk will be constraints on non-Gaussian molecular structure. And this is what a lot of people are talking about. Here's this nice graph from Marilena's paper that we already saw this morning. And basically, in terms of looking at different scales, CMB looks at the largest scales. And I won't talk about that anymore much. Then we have the galaxy surveys, like the bispectrum at smaller scales, and still smaller scales, galaxy clusters, counting clusters as a function of redshift and mass, possibly, and seeing if the counts agree with Gaussian expectation. In particular, now, if you are trained as a cosmologist, you already know this, but if not, just in case, I will say it. Cluster counts, we use something called the mass function, which is the number of collapsed objects per unit mass, possibly per redshift, expected. And this is exponentially falling function of mass. It's calibrated very well in a Gaussian realizations from simulation. It's universal, which means basically that it depends only on the RMS variance of density perturbations. So as a function of this parameter, actually as a function of this function, that it's actually specified. And here's, you know, simulations.
Calibration of the mass function. So this mass function, we compare counts to those predicted by mass function for any given cosmology, and we decide whether that cosmology is ruled out or consistent with. Now, just a few more basics on how this works. Preston-Schechter formalism, very famous formalism, says that the number of collapsed objects in any given mass interval is really equal to the area under the tail of the probability density distribution. And this probability density distribution is just integral. It's actually the tail, so it's integral or under the PDF from that mass threshold to infinity. And then there's a very famous factor of two, which says, well, we took into account over densities, but didn't take into account under densities. So therefore, let's multiply by two. And then because this is Gaussian, once you take derivative of f, you're only taking derivative of this limit. So in fact, you can get a very nice formula, which is a Preston-Schechter mass formula that fits simulations pretty well. Nowadays, of course, we know the many limits in which it fails, but it works pretty well in general. And so this is this variance of this formula are used often to bring together data in theory, in particular to have predictions for counts of objects. Now, how does this change in a non-Gaussian limit? So in the case when we have non-Gaussian density perturbations. So there's something called extended Preston-Schechter formalism, which is makes it quite confusing, because this expression actually means more than one thing in cosmology. But one of the meanings of extended Preston-Schechter is to predict non-Gaussian number counts, just replace Gaussian with non-Gaussian. So here, instead of PG, just put in PNG and repeat the same thing. So that's to be done. Now, of course, once you have P non-Gaussian here, the derivative here is more complicated, and it becomes cumbersome to do it. In fact, often you have to numerically arrange initial conditions and literally, or you know, have your PDF and numerically compute the tail. To avoid that, there's also another popular set of formulae, better known as MVJ, after Matarese, Verte, and Jimenez. And what they say is, well, they expand the PNG in cumulants and keep the skewness term, and then they're able to take that derivative of the integral, and then they end up with a formula that looks quite similar to this, but has skewness terms. The one thing that I'd like to point out is that for Preston-Schechter, there's no really fundamental reason why it should work, I think, although, you know, this is, I mean, I guess it depends who you ask. But certainly for these non-Gaussian formulae, I really don't think there's a fundamental reason why they should work, although they may work, because This is a conjecture to begin with, and now the second conjecture is replace Gaussian and non-Gaussian. Let's see what happens. So the bottom line is that it just seems like a good idea to check these formulae with numerical simulations, and this is what we set out to do.
Can I ask a question? That when you change PG to PNG, then there's two ways in which that can change. One is that PNG remains a function of delta C over sigma. And so you just have, instead of a Gaussian in there, you have some other shape. The other possibility is that that shape itself depends on M on the scale, which I think is correct.
You're asking which one is it?
Well, so I think it's correct that the scale, the shape of the PDF itself is now scale dependent.
Yes.
And so I guess what I'm asking is, when MVJ did their calculation, was it scale dependent?
I guess I should ask Licha.
Just put everything on. So sigma is depends on scale, so depends on M.
But PG, so PNG, suppose it was a chi-square, you just use the chi-square?
Oh, so the form, when you expand, you have the cumulants, and then you have S3, and S3 depends on mass, so depends on scale. So you compute the dependence.
Yeah, but that's what you do.
Perspective is a nice formula, but people who have done simulations since then know that the mass function is not Prescheck, right? Even in
Gaussian. Oh, yeah. So this actually, I didn't point this out. I guess you're getting to the point that this can be repeated with non-Prescheck or similar formulae, but the same replacement done. Is that what you're asking?
But it is, then it becomes more complicated, right?
They're more complicated, but they have the Gaussian e to the minus x squared term. Is that right?
But some of these simulation mass functions are already non-Gaussian, right?
Well, it's not non-Gaussian, but it's not Prescheckter.
Okay.
Right, so underlying Prescheckter is already not accurate, so why bother to start from the Prescheckter?
That's right, so I think these are usually starting, well, I can be corrected again. These are usually starting from Jenkins and such.
But how do you do that? That's surprising, because you can't do that, right? Jenkins has nothing to do with underlying PDF.
Oh, right, so one thing, yeah, that's right. So we are coming to the gray territory now. So anyway,
we should actually let you continue because we're probably going.
Let me just answer this quickly because now that you asked. So one quick, and I mean, I won't take too much of a blame for this because this is what people do. So to say the mass function is equal to, and this seems reasonable to do, they say the mass function is equal to Jenkins of the fiducial times the ratio, so Gaussian Jenkins times the ratio of Prescheckter non-Gaussian to Prescheckter Gaussian. Another type of thing that you can do, and no fundamental reason why. That's supposed to get you closer.
Especially that, I mean, maybe Ravi can comment on this, but that does sort of make sense theoretically, because what changes in the different formulae is you say not statistics of the density fluctuations are changing in any weird way, but that your threshold is mass dependent. So it would seem natural to put it in that way, to say you have a term that's just have a threshold that has a mass, and a term that just depends on the statistics.
That's right.
Yeah, but whether that can be captured by ratio
is
unclear, right?
Okay.
Seems reasonable, I agree, but it needs to be really done from the first principle.
Okay, yeah. So anyway, I agree with all of that. Let me move on, and then we'll see. So we ran simulations with non-Gaussian initial conditions. This is the fiducial ones are 512 cubed particles, 800 megaparsecs over h, and we also had 1024 cubed giants with 1600 megaparsecs over h simulations. We, in this case, being mostly near the lab. This is the same initial condition. So we had this thing where we had the same Gaussian underlying field, but then you change F and L, so you end up with a different overall potential in the beginning. So this is comparison for different F and L's, and these are, of course, gigantic values from very low to very high, and then zero, which is Gaussian. And you see what happens is, basically, for the same structures become much more pronounced, much more massive in plus F and L, and tend to get washed away for negative F and L. So this is just a generic type of thing you see. And, you know, there's, each halo we looked at had at least 400 particles. So, you know, we tried to make sure its resolution and such things were sufficient. This is the mass function that we get as a function of FNL. So, again, something you definitely expect. For positive FNL, you get more massive things, and for negative FNL, you get less massive things. And this is ratio relative to the FNL of zero case. Now, one thing we've done is we didn't try. Now, we like to compare this to fitting formulae and also have our own fitting formula from simulation. What we did is we didn't try to fit these mass functions with some formula that depends on FNL. But rather, we did something else that we thought was a clever trick. And we look at each individual cluster. And of course, you can note that this one and the same cluster in different simulations is more massive than positive for positive FNL and less massive than fiducial for negative FNL. So in fact, instead of looking at the full mass function, you can look at its raw ingredient, the mass of a cluster or mass of a halo. So in particular, any given halo will be more massive, again, like I said, for positive FNL and less massive for negative FNL.
What is the definition of halo mass? I mean, this is like the constant of a density or something.
This is friends of friends algorithm.
Okay.
Okay, so this is again the type of thing you see. This is sort of the Gaussian mass, and this is the non-Gaussian mass for FNL 500.
And you see most of the time, if this was Gaussian and Gaussian, of course, you'd get a perfect 45-degree line here. What happens is individual clusters get scattered up or down, and preferentially, because this is positive FNL, they get scattered upwards in mass. So there's some overall shift in mass up in this case for any given cluster. So what we parameterize is not the mass function, but rather this mass shift. And you can see that this shift in mass has two main pieces to it just by eye. One is the mean, and the other one is the variance that's not zero.
So I understand that if you do have a cluster, then when you turn on the non-Gaussianity, it will become more massive. But also, you may have that in the Gaussian case, you don't have a cluster, but by turning in the non-Gaussianity, you have a cluster where before you didn't.
Yeah, this
so
can happen.
There are two components.
But it's just the mass of the cluster that changes. I mean, it's not that you have no cluster and all of a sudden you have a cluster. It's just different mass. No?
Well, you may be that something that you wouldn't call a cluster or you wouldn't detect like a cluster, it becomes.
So for small FNL, this small FNL, this smoothly goes in the limit where you just are not creating clusters out of the blue. Because it is based on one and the same simulation. So if I go to FNL very small, I'm guaranteed to recover exactly 45-degree line here. So this is a controlled experiment where you perturb by FNL, tune FNL, and when it's small, then you're not creating things out of the blue or making them disappear.
So you've got the same phases and things, you're just messing with the amplitudes a little bit?
Well, this is the underlying Gaussian field is the same.
Okay.
But you get phase correlations by adding the FNL.
So you assume you have no creation of new halos?
Yeah, it doesn't happen. It does happen very rarely.
It must happen at some level.
It will happen at some level when FNL becomes big. Yes.
But this is the rarest object. So for each of the rare ones, you have many more of the ones that are less rare fluctuations. So.
They get upscattered in mass.
If they get upscattered, then it's much more likely that something that you didn't call cluster, then you end up calling it a cluster after you switch on non-Gaussianity. So I think it's the definition of what we call
it,
cluster.
That might be happening here, though, like lower mass.
Yeah.
You have separate.
Yeah, it will happen at lower mass. A very high mass, no, but a low mass, yes.
Yes. It might be happening at some level.
So you have two different simulations. How could you say this is the same cluster in these two different simulations?
Yeah, looking at ID of a particle and seeing where are you now at the end.
Where all the particles are.
Yes, where are you for each particle?
What if they are in two different clusters in one? I mean, yeah, they are in one cluster in one simulation or in two different clusters in another.
So now you're asking, let me maybe move on. I actually haven't done this part, and there is maybe some wiggle room here. This we'll show this works, but so it's a...
So there could be things that are not virialized for Gaussian initial condition, and they are virialized for non-Gaussian initial condition. So it really depends how you call a cluster. Do you call the same area where there are the same particle with the same ID, and then I sum them up, or do I look what is?
So clusters are determined by friends of friends. But then when you do that, once you do that, then you ask, each one in the cluster 4 are euphoric. I think that's how it is.
So you can check this by just computing the mass function for each level of FNL.
I have comparisons. Yeah. Okay, so coming up, yeah.
Just so you can do a creation and a destruction.
Yeah, right.
No, I agree this is a funny business anyway, but it seems to, okay. So what we have now is the mass function is actually, this is just kind of an obvious formula, it's the Gaussian mass function times this kernel that tells you how you upscatter or downscatter the masses. So in the Gaussian case, this would be a delta function, but now it's some, we assume this is a Gaussian, although it's not a Gaussian, but it's a very good approximation. This is a Gaussian where you, that has some mean, so mean in how much you scatter, and then the variance, which you obviously saw from the previous graph, you know, what's the width. These are the fitting formulae for the mean shift. This is a fitting formula for the variance. And this one, mean is proportional to FNL. Variance is proportional to FNL to some power. And these are fitting formulae. So this is, this is what we do. So to compute the final mass function, once you have these as a function of FNL, then it's a trivial exercise of just doing this integral over the Gaussian mass function for any given FNL. So FNL dependence is here. And so this is just a Gaussian with this mean and this variance. Okay, I think this graph is showing that that works well. So here is some more of that. This is a mass function for different redshifts and FNL of 500. And let me see, the error bars must be from the simulation. I think the dashed line is going through them by definition, and the solid line is the fit function. So the function fit that I just showed, the mean and the variance. Likewise, if you just literally plot this non-Gaussian to Gaussian ratios, and this now has to be positive FNL 0 and negative FNL, although I don't see the label right at the moment. And again, there's this is now the results of simulations. Anyway, so that fits sufficiently well the formula I showed. Yes.
Question about philosophy. So we know that the mass function is really a function of the scaling, in Gaussian simulations, function of delta over sigma.
Uh-huh.
So why not calibrate the fitting formula for mf given m to be sigma f given sigma?
Oh, you'd like to calibrate sigma, not m.
Yeah, because isn't that the natural thing to do? And then you get these curves, that these adjustments that won't depend on the input power spectrum.
Ah, right. Then you won't have these. Right. That's a good idea. I don't know. I guess we were motivated by looking at those. That's in Halo, how it looks differently. Yes. That's a good point. I don't know if we do better or equally or worse.
Sorry, I'm confused. Aren't you fixing the variance to be the same? I mean,
this is a different variance. Sorry, we're talking about a different variance.
Oh.
So he means sigma when he says variance.
Sigma m.
Yeah.
Sigma is a function of the mass.
He doesn't mean this. He means. Right. So there's two sigmas here. They're different things. Yeah. I apologize.
A few sigmas, then. but actually, so this has more information than the mass function, though, doesn't it? Because mass function doesn't.
I would think so. Yes. It's more.
It's a two-dimensional.
This is a like sort of, yeah. Well, that is a good principle question. But yes, either way. Okay, so I showed this. And let's see now, finally, comparison to fitting formulae. These are plus 500, plus 500 minus 500 FNL. What's plotted is mass function ratio, this is probably number count ratio, to Gaussian at different masses at three different redshifts. I apologize for the mess of many curves. Let me show what's shown. So black is Z of 0, blue is Z of 1/2, red is Z of 1. The error bars are simulations. The smooth, thick curves are our fitting formulae, and the dashed and dotted are EPS and MVJ prescriptions. And things get, what happens at high Z is you run out of these very highly massive objects, so things become much noisier. But basically what we find is that if these two agree with each other, as they should, but we find that they disagree with our simulations at a factor that's about a factor of 2, maybe 50%, maybe a little more than a factor of 2, but order unity factor.
What's EPS and what's NVJ prescription?
Extended fast factor, this is when the one, when you take...
You put a skewness in it.
You put non-Gaussian PDF instead of Gaussian, and NVJ is when you further expand in skewness. Mm-hmm.
What do you mean when you further expand it?
So it's business on this. This is EPS, this is MVJ. Okay, let me move on because otherwise I'll...
Are those mass functions, are they all normal? So the factor of two, you have to recalculate it if you change the PDF. Are all of the mass functions normalized in the same? If you integrate above mass, do you get back the mean density?
I remember worrying about this at some point. I'm not sure if I remember the answer. I'm not sure even that's so important. This factor of two will get changed into something that's not two.
I mean, it can. It doesn't have to. I'm just wondering.
It would change a little
bit. It'll change a little bit, but I think that won't be, it'll be a small change that's much order less unity. It won't be like one. It'll be two plus correction. So I don't think that's important for, I remember worrying about this, I don't remember offhand what the deal is. But, okay, let me move on. So, what we find is, anyway, we find that the traditional formulae overestimate the effect by maybe a factor of two. You see there's more suppression and more. This here bump is because of going to a smaller box to higher box. In CF1, it's very hard to map all these things. But also, it's important to note that regardless these formulae that we have, what I like about them is that you can do these types of integrals very easily. So this is a known mass function. You just put it through this Gaussian kernel. And for example, to use the EPS formula, what some people like, well, those of you who follow Saki et al., they did is they laid out the initial field, and they were sort of doing this thing where they read up the tail of the PDF, which I find actually surprisingly cumbersome, just because as a theorist, you like to set a formula and not worry about any realizations of the field.
Does the agreement get better for smaller FNL?
I forgot. Let's see, as FNL goes to zero, both of them go to one, so yes. Mm-hmm. It must be.
The question is asking slightly different, because when you put FNL equals zero, you kill completely the correction.
That's true,
so
too.
If there was something wrong in the correction, we wouldn't be able to see this way. The trick is to change FNL and see whether the ratio converges.
We had this for 15,500, but things are these things tend to be more noisy for small FNL.
Why are there breaks in the curve?
Because this is going, you need like a larger box to actually find these giants at ZO1.
So you didn't compute the same, you didn't compute it in one single simulation?
Mostly one, but we had to pack on the sec. Yeah, there was a couple of simulations. Yes, there were. Yeah. Okay, let me move on. So that's the formula. Okay, and right, so this is now assuming actually quite a similar survey that we heard in Marilena's talk. SPT, 7,000 clusters, 4,000 square degrees. This is counting clusters between 0.1 and 1.5. Planck prior, however, no non Gaussianity from Planck. Here we just use it to fix some cosmological parameters. This is the WFNL plane. This is equation of state of dark energy in FNL, marginalizing over all other parameters. There are about 7 or 8 of them. And basically, what you see is what I already said, that these prescriptions, that they were apparently overestimating the effect of non-Gaussianity, therefore you get artificially small errors relative to simulations. These are 1 and 2 signals. Likewise, you see as a function of the maximum extent of the survey, SPT in this case, again, we get weaker results. This is logarithmic scale now, weaker results than the formulae, because what we thought it was overestimated the effect. I should note there are other papers that showed up around this time. They disagree with each other and with us. That's good. So Kang, Norberg, and Silk found actually a much bigger discrepancy than with MBJ formula than we did. And this paper almost certainly is not to be trusted because of the low number of particles in their simulations, and as they themselves know. This other paper, Grossi et al., they actually found perfect agreement with MBJ formula. And they had more particles. So what they show here is cumulative count. This is the ratio to Gaussian of cumulative counts of clusters as a function of mass and for four different redshifts and for different FNLs. So there's a lot of going on. What you note, each smooth curve is going through the data points. They found excellent agreement. We don't know whether this, why we differ from them. It's hard to compare because they have these cumulative counts and they have different cosmology. We probably think we are right. They probably think they are right.
I think somebody else should check this independently just to see if there's agreement.
The bits of code that do the initial non-Gaussian conditions.
That requires work, yes. Yeah, that should be that. No, I agree, yes. This was all pretty recent business, and then I think everybody was exhausted.
Do you know what group finder they're using?
I don't actually remember.
Because signals could depend quite sensitively on the group finder, too, right? Because you're actually defining masses in quite different ways with kinds of transfer things. So, an obvious example is if things are less spherical, friends of friends will preserve that mass, whereas spherical upper density won't. So,
good point. They use gadget code, different code. I don't know what finder they use.
They use friends of friends and spherical over density.
Okay, so that sounds right.
And do they compare it?
Yeah.
Because certainly the peaks are less spherical. Naively, I think if you make things less Gaussian, you get less spherical.
Yeah. That's a good point. That could be.
So there's a curious thing if you look at these plots. If you look at redshift 0, then that ratio is 0.2 for the most massive clusters.
Uh-huh.
Whereas at redshift 5, that ratio is 0.5 or log red. So it seems like the effect was bigger at high redshift.
It's supposed to be.
I agree the theory curves are there, right? But so this is just me again giving another plug for scaling things in terms of delta over sigma. Because those halos, those 10 to the 13 at high redshift, they're very high sigma, right? And that's why it's like that.
Uh-huh.
Presumably that's why it's like that. But so I suspect that it will be useful to parameterize everything.
Yes,
in terms of
yes. But I should also know that we're now talking about fitting formula, right, which is independent of this business who agrees with who, because now I'm really talking simulation.
Correct.
Okay, good. Okay, let me move on. Now there's something sort of very slightly shifting gears, still talking about the same paper. Another result that we stumbled upon pretty accidentally, and we found that pretty exciting, which is bias of dark matter halos. Just to remind you, bias is defined as delta rho over rho
in dark matter relative in visible matter in halos that we measure relative to delta rho over rho in dark matter. So this is bias, which can be a function of time and scale. This can be measured in cosmology. And this is what simulations predict for bias. So this is bias as a function of scale at halos of different mass measured in simulations. And one thing you take away from this is that the bias on large scale is constant. And there's something going on with this curve that's the highest mass. But if you just block that out for a moment, bias is a constant. This is actually a theorem if halo abundance is a function of local density only, that bias is constant in K at large scales. Moreover, you can do things like measure bias as a function of mass. Again, some well-known results, and Ravi has done pioneering work in this area. There's simulation results and what theory predicts, and the two pretty well agree, except on a certain range of scales. So just setting stage, we are talking about bias now, which is delta rho over rho in halos relative to that in dark matter. What we found in these non-Gaussian simulations is that this bias becomes a function of scale. So in fact, we can look at the power spectra that now take different shapes at large K, but might be most significant to look at the bias as a function of K, and you see that depending on what FNL you're looking for, the bias picks up stronger and stronger scale dependence as you go to larger and larger scales, to lower and lower K. And so this can be understood. So the bias, in fact, goes as k to the minus 2, 1 over k squared. This can be understood in the following way. We are talking about this model with constant FNL. And this is a phi, small phi is Gaussian, big phi is not. Then when you take Laplacian, you end up with terms of this sort. And then now you have good and nice Laplacians of Gaussian. And we know really well what to do with those. We can also use Poisson equation. So in particular, now you can compute statistics of anything in this model. For example, you can compute the skewness, and you get certain formulae that will correlate gravitational potential and the upper density. And so in particular, you can find very easily, and this is kind of the back of the envelope calculation, that the non-Gaussian overdensity is related to the Gaussian case offset by 2 FNL phi, where phi is the gravitational potential, or minus thereof, actually. And so it's proportional to FNL. So in fact, you can do things like, if you look at Lagrangian bias, which is the one in co-moving coordinates, or the early, you know, initial conditions bias, so to speak. And so we look at the bias, and you realize that for non-Gaussian realization, the overdensity changes with FNL in this way, and there's some approximations that are well justified in this. Delta C is the critical overdensity for collapse, which is 1.69 or so. This is the potential. So this is near the peaks. Once you realize that the bias shifts, then you realize you can, what's the word? You can subsume this variation in the overdensity by the change in bias. And if you just compare these two equations and do algebra one line of, and also use Poisson's equation, you basically find that the change in bias is proportional to all these things. So the delta B is proportional to FNL and also goes as 1 over k squared. And so this is sort of the main result, that the bias depends on scale. The same thing has been confirmed by Materese and Verde, who also point out correctly that you need to take into account the transfer function of the power spectrum, evolution at late times, and also Niyayish and Tolle in preparation day. They have this and a lot more stuff showing results relative to the bias of scaling as a function of scale. So just to show, this is, we have some analytic results. We have some simulation results. That's how we first discovered this scaling with K. How well do the two agree? And in fact, the two agree to, you know, maybe 10%. So this should be one. For perfect agreement, it's 0.9, the agreement between. We listened to you is what happened, and we made one of the changes the IR suggested, but let me not get into technicalities. The agreement is good. Yeah. So what does this mean? And so here's where I'm sort of more other people will have done more work on this, we'll talk about it. This means that cosmological probes of bias, like baryon acoustic oscillations and integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, any probe of cosmology that can measure bias, can actually then indirectly via bias measure non-Gaussianity. We did Beckman in the envelope calculations. True Beckman in the envelope means very non-rigorous. And they show that, in fact, you can measure sigma to order 10 for LRG survey, which is, if you remember my contours for cluster count, this is an order of magnitude better. So potentially an order of magnitude than previously thought just from this dependence of bias. Moreover, integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect that correlates delta T over T in the CMB with delta galaxies over galaxies in the galaxy survey is proportional linearly to B, and that also potentially can measure non-Gaussianity better than previously thought. Niyayish will have, I think, a lot more and some interesting results to show about this. I was hoping I'd have more, better Fisher matrix calculation for today, but it didn't happen. So these are just back on the envelope.
Of 30%, not 3%.
Oh, yeah,
I think
really?
I really could do much better, but okay,
if you do the number 30 better. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. In conclusion, the main result is the last thing I talked about, that cosmological models that with local primordial non-Gaussianity lead to the strong dependence on scale of the bias. And so therefore, measuring bias, you can get very good constraints on FNL in this case. Therefore, these largely structured probes, such as galaxy CMB cross-correlations or other probes, BAO, they can be actually quite good probes of non-Gaussianity. In particular, Shorty and Tolle have a paper in preparation. And also I've heard, although I haven't seen it, Padmanabhan and Stossa have also a paper constraining this from current LRG surveys, current galaxies. We also provide formulae that are actually accurate and easy to use fitting formulae for cluster counts. Although after this, you see that cluster counts, they just don't seem to be competitive with either the CMB or potentially this bias BRK measurements work. They are quite a bit weaker. And this would be good to look at this type of bias dependence and scale for other non-Gaussian models, such as people like yourself. Thank you.
We have a lot, but maybe a couple left over.
So it's a practical question about how you actually measure this, right? We are kind of assuming that at this scale, the Gaussian case will give you constant bias.
Yeah, it will give you constant bias.
I don't know. I mean, non-linearity.
You're worried about another.
Dependent.
In the same, I would say the simplest scenario, you would introduce FNL as an extra parameter in analysis, and you'd worry equally about it as much as you worry about any other parameter in your analysis.
So maybe that's what Nikki and Anzi are.
I don't know what they are doing. I mean, this
crack error is a strongly scale dependent bias.
But see that those Gross K changes are power, though, the non-linear bias.
So you are fitting to this, like a Q parameter.
But this is one over K.
That's right. So you just have the different functional form.
Yeah, and I think there is very little degenerate solution because of the very little.
I think you'd worry at the same level as you worry about other things, but you would worry.
Yeah.
Can we go back a few slides to the one where you had the mass, I think you call it mass final versus mass initial or something, inside the integral?
I forgot how to do this.
You had movies in
Yeah, that's so this is how you calculate your mass function in the non-Gaussian case. But let's suppose, I mean, part of the shift in the mass function is coming from the bias, which you pointed out in the previous plot. But isn't, according to this formula, some would come just from the scatter alone. Isn't that right? Because there are more small mass things than high mass things, and so if you have anything that scatters, you're going to move things from more things from low to high than the other direction. So let me give you a scenario. Let's say we just have one simulation that's Gaussian, okay, and we use two different halo finder routines that find more or less the same halos but with slightly different masses. Isn't it true that if you apply this formula, you know, you plot one against the other in the same way, measure the scatter, it's unbiased, but there's a scatter. Now we use this formula, we're going to get a shifted mass function as a result of that scatter.
I didn't quite understand. What do you do in the second scenario?
Let's say, just for example, we run a different halo finder.
Different halo finder.
Okay? Same simulation, different halo finder, but we pretend it's like you've done here, that it's a different simulation. Because there's a scatter, in the two masses, there's some scatter. And then, now if we just ran a mass function on that with the other halo finder, we presumably get the same mass function. But I think if you apply this formula here, you're going to find that, you know, because of the scatter,
you're worried about the scatter term,
you're going to scatter more things from the low mass end higher than the other way around, and you're going to get a different mass function. So I'm not sure this formula is what you want. Monquist bias, exactly.
Monquist
bias. Well, different people mean different things by that, but I agree. It's a Monquist bias.
Can I turn your argument around?
Yeah.
Say, people should do this to parameterize the difference between the spherical overdensity mass function and the friends of friends mass function. Because yes, there is the scatter and it does contribute, and that's true. And you will get a different mass function both because of potential bias and because of the scatter. That's correct.
But it's not real. That's what I'm saying. The real mass function that you would measure, you know, if let's say that on average each one works equally well, you would get the same mass function. But if you apply this formula, you're going to get a mass function which is shifted to higher masses due to the Monquist bias.
I don't think there is any real mass function. By your definition of
well,
mass
if I run a halo finder and I identify some halo, I can plot the mass function. Okay? But if I start with the mass function from one halo finder, I measure the scatter of another one with respect to that first one, and then apply this formula, I don't think I'll get the same answer that I would have done if I'd just done that.
You would have. I think you should do it for any halo mass finder, you should go through the whole thing. For different mass finders, or halo finders.
Yeah, I just don't like this particular, I'm worried about this, using this formula as opposed to doing it the straightforward way, which is just measuring the mass function. Because I think this introduces a bias.
I'm not so sure about that. I doubt it, because this is just probably different discussion for later. But,
yeah, I'm not sure we're converging, actually. So shall we
move on?
So just as curiosity, while Licha sets up, I thought it'd be interesting to ask how many people got their PhDs before 1998, because my impression is that there are very few
old people here.
Wait, old is 1998 or earlier?
You mean to be quarter like energy?
It's quite unusual to see how many young people there are here.
I think all people are busy.